This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The State Farm building in downtown Bloomington will be torn down. Now what?
A vacant lot. Is it redevelopable? It sure is. That will be a somewhat easy chore to do. Compared to a 13-story building, I think it's going to struggle.
Commercial realtor Greg Yant says there are opportunities for that downtown location. An in-depth report on the startling development coming up. Plus, Great Caesar's Ghost, Laura Kennedy, presents a modern political take on Shakespeare's classic. John Norton has something from Bad Boys ahead of their concert. And a thoughtful discussion about the disappearance of a mural in the community. No, not that mural. And what murals say about us as a society. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. What's next for downtown Bloomington following State Farm's surprise announcement yesterday? It will be demolishing its former headquarters there. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner calls it a sad day.
The loss of that building in particular is sad for those of us who are, you know, strongly interested in historic preservation, and I include myself in that. I mean, it was, in a sense, the skyline for downtown Bloomington.
It's unclear what derailed the sale. It was 4 months ago when State Farm announced it had found a buyer for the historic downtown structure. The buyer was never identified. They reportedly wanted to fill it with a restaurant, retail, and offices. Yesterday, State Farm said the sale did not materialize, despite the best efforts of all parties. A spokesperson says it's a very large building, and it's not uncommon for this to happen in complex real estate deals. And because the building is so big and hard to maintain, and with the prospect of another vacant eyesore in downtown, State Farm decided demolition was the best option. Thursday's news came as a surprise to many, including Greg Yant, manager at Coldwell Banker Commercial Real Estate in Bloomington.
I think we're all sitting here on the edge of our seat, hoping that the transaction whereby the building would stay and be renovated for different uses would happen, right?
Bloomington schools will lose about $150,000 per year in property tax money when the State Farm building in downtown Bloomington goes away. District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley says to put the property tax from the State Farm building in context, that amounts to about three teachers per year. Riley says another way to consider the loss is as an offset, roughly, to the amount of money the state has increased general aid for District 87 under the new funding formula. Riley says District 87 will adjust, but it is a significant decrease. The demolition presents another economic development challenge and opportunity for city leaders looking to revitalize downtown Bloomington. Here is Mayor Renner.
We've certainly had lots of successes. This is not one of them.
Renner and Yount say there are some advantages to having a shovel-ready site available in a location like that if a developer wants to pursue a hotel or retail.
That would be a potentially good location for maybe a boutique hotel, sure. Office space, professional office space, sure. As, you know, there are a couple law firms or accounting firms or professional office users that would go in there. You know, I think in the same light that we see some activity occurring in Uptown Normal with regard to office users, I think certainly downtown Bloomington could perhaps draw some of those people. You know, maybe first floor would work for the right kind of a retailer, and then you have a couple of floors of office use. Could we do new downtown condos? I've always struggled with the cost versus value on residential, but maybe not impossible.
The building served as State Farm's headquarters until 1974. It was once home to hundreds of employees. State Farm has already removed and preserved historic items from the building for eventual display. The last batch of employees were relocated out of the building last year when State Farm put it up for sale. The State Farm insurance signage came down last fall. Local historian Greg Koo says State Farm has long been the leading corporate citizen in Bloomington.
To walk away from the central city and destroy a asset that has considerable future use would seem to signal a withdrawal of its obligation as a citizen. I don't know that I believe that's true.
Jamie Mathey is a Bloomington City Council member and downtown business owner.
That's not what they have communicated, you know, many times in the past. You know, they're trying to revitalize how they how their internal workforce goes, works with each other, and moving to some of the kind of modern thoughts on open floor spaces, which my understanding was this building did not work well with that concept.
The demolition process will begin in a few months and take about a year to complete. Historian Greg Koo says that's a shame because State Farm has maintained the building and it does retain a lot of value in his view.
The State Farm building was designed by the Schaefer Houghton firm, who were successors to the Pillsbury firm, the best architects of the period in our community. And they started off with an eight-story skyscraper, and as the corporation continued to grow, that building continued to grow. And it's a marvelous example of Art Deco architecture in the downtown, and it is also a contributing structure to the National Register of Historic Places district that is downtown Bloomington. Downtown Bloomington has been recognized as a National Register of Historic Places district.
Realtor Greg Yant says it was on the market for more than a year, and sometimes you have to take a step back to take two steps forward.
How many more years does it need to be on the market to determine that, you know, maybe it just wasn't meant to be?
But Greg Koos says losing this historic building is also a loss of a structure that helps create a sense of the community, a sense of a thriving community, and conveys the length of that thriving that is the history of Bloomington. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Restore Therapy Services at Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, a premier orthopedic provider serving seniors in the Bloomington Normal community for more than 50 years. Visit heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Julius Caesar was, after all, a politician in addition to a general. And the Illinois Shakespeare Festival takes Shakespeare's classic into a political campaign. The McLean County Museum of History joins its annual Lincoln Fest this weekend. GLT's Mary Cullen speaks with Frank Norris, a historian of the National Park Service, ahead of his presentation on what life was like for African Americans traveling along Route 66 ahead of the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Well, Route 66 was a adventurous, fun way for Americans to head out toward the Great Plains, the Mountain West, and the Pacific Coast from the 1930s to the 1970s. Those who traveled the road when as African Americans found it challenging, and there were a number of impediments along the way.
Listeners might be most familiar with the movie that came out last year called Green Book, and it told the true story of Don Shirley, an African-American pianist traveling through the U.S. in the early 1960s. But the film got its namesake from a book written by Victor Hugo Green. Can you tell us a little bit about the book itself?
Victor Green was a postal worker in the Harlem section of New York City, but he also ran a travel agency on the side, and he knew a number of people in the black community in Harlem, and during the early to mid-1930s was a time in which there was a large and growing black middle class. They wanted to travel like so many other people. They had automobiles, but they were in a difficult position because the highways of America, both north and south, were hostile places to them. They wanted to have a chance to go to Alabama to visit their grandparents. They wanted to have a chance to go out west and see the national parks. They wanted to have a chance to travel and see America like everyone else did. But they also wanted respectability, and the last thing that they wanted was to have people slam doors in their faces when they wanted to go to hotels and restaurants. They contacted Victor Green and said, can you put together a directory for us that lists accommodations that will welcome us?
So the Green Book then was more of a broad look at across the entire U.S. And in your presentation on Saturday is detailing specifically on Route 66, correct?
That's correct. And really the lessons that I learned are pretty broadly applicable all around the country.
From your research, maybe you could take listeners on a journey as an African American traveling on Route 66, whether moving from east to west or west to east, I'll leave that up to you. But maybe you could tell us a little bit about what that was like and the experiences that they had.
Most travelers along Route 66, black or white, oftentimes started in Chicago, which of course had a large black population, but blacks leaving Chicago really didn't know what that landscape out there was like, although they probably had some hunches that in certain places the landscape was pretty hostile. So before the Green Book came along, they had learned various techniques on how to get by so that they could find places to stay. For instance, they might drive along the main street of a town, look for a black passerby and say, where can we stay or where can we have a meal? But sometimes when people headed out on long journeys, they didn't have that bank of information and they simply just drove straight on through. They might pack a picnic basket and just keep on driving unless they obviously needed gas. They otherwise just drove all night long.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Mary Cullen speaking with Frank Norris, a historian for the National Park Service. What about public transportation? How did that come into play?
Well, African Americans look forward to driving America's highways because it did not have a lot of the sort of structural impediments that other forms of transportation did. In the South, for instance, there were Jim Crow cars where all blacks were told to travel. There were, on buses, oftentimes blacks needed to sit in the back of the bus. Obviously, the personal vehicle gave blacks the freedom to be able to drive wherever they wanted and however they wanted. So it was a real vehicle of freedom for them. The only trouble was the sides of the roads were not integrated, and they ran across a lot of the same hostilities, though in just different forms, once they pulled over and tried to get something to eat or a place to stay.
As you mentioned earlier, those leaving Chicago and really taking Route 66 west out to California or wherever their destination was, how did it change from moving from Chicago to the more rural areas as you approach California?
The rural areas changed a good deal as you left Chicago and headed west across the Midwest, across the plains, and toward the Pacific coast. One of the things that I looked for in my research was whether this pattern of sundown towns changed significantly as you went from the Midwest toward the Pacific coast. Actually, what I found was that in many areas of New Mexico and Arizona, many of the small towns were in fact sundown towns, but there were also instances that many of those supposed sundown towns may have been on Indian reservations, or there simply was no industry or economic support that might have attracted blacks historically. So the question remains as to whether these areas had reasons to be sundown towns more in the classic sense, or whether there simply weren't any economic attractors to bring African Americans into those areas.
As a society, we know that as time changes, culture changes with it. And it's not always everywhere follows the same path, but how do you see that we have changed as a culture since looking at, say, the Green Book movie that came out was based in the 1960s compared to where we are today?
Nationally, there were many indications during the 1950s that attitudes toward blacks, you know, among certain white groups were becoming more tolerant. But the evidence is mixed in many other parts of Route 66. So I didn't really find any evidence that in Texas or Oklahoma, Missouri, that there was any particular softening all the way up until the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964. And of course, the passage of that act required that all owners of public accommodations, such as motels and restaurants, were required to open their doors to people of all races.
So we've covered a lot today, but what else can listeners expect to hear and learn from you during your presentation?
I think one thing that they'll be somewhat surprised about is to find out from the black point of view just what a scary landscape it was out there. Those people who have already seen the movie will recognize that the Green Book movie was a stark, accurate representation of what life was like for black travelers prior to the Civil Rights Act. What they may be surprised about, however, was that attitudes in some northern states were just as rigid and uncompromising as they were in the Jim Crow South. It was more a matter of custom and less of law, but the prohibitions against blacks were just as strong.
WGLT's Mary Cullen speaking with National Park Service historian Frank Norris. Catch his presentation, Courageous Motorists, tomorrow at 1:30 at the McLean County Museum of History.
Support for GLT comes from Vitesse Cycle Shop, where your patronage and friendship is valued. Vitesse Cycle's goal is to promote health and well-being through cycling. Learn more about the Electra Townie and other bike brands, all with Vitesse's professional advice, service, and accessories at VitesseCycle.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up in just a few minutes, John Norton talks with some bad boys ahead of their concert tonight in Bloomington Normal. Julius Caesar downs a poisonous cocktail of ambition and power in a new adaptation of Shakespeare's play now running at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. In this modern media-saturated version of the classic tale, hashtags as much as daggers do the dirty work in dangerous political power plays. GLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
This is a perfect time for a modern version of Caesar. That's according to director Ketta Carpenter, who also adapted the work from Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Carpenter drew on her experience on a national political campaign to craft this exploration of power and political warfare.
We're living in a world where, you know, our politics are part of our daily lives in a way that they haven't been in much of my lifetime. And the way that we're watching media influence public opinion and reaction to media and all of those things happening, I think it makes doing a modern version of Caesar right now particularly timely.
So you're using a lot of technology, media, in your production. Tell me about how you incorporated it, the choices that you made with regards to what you decided to include and why.
So when you modernize a Shakespeare play, there's always this problem of social media, that now we communicate over social media so much and we communicate by text so much that to have things like a letter going astray doesn't make sense anymore. And this isn't one of the plays that has a letter going astray. But if you look at how something would happen in this world, nobody's going to stand in the town square and listen to the funeral oration. That doesn't happen. Where does that happen now? That happens in a press conference. So looking at where would this thing happen now if it was, you know, what's the version of this that would happen now? So social media is very incorporated, text messages, also news content.
So there's screens up all over the theater. Do you maybe have an app people could download before they go to the show in order to sort of make it more participatory?
We're working on this right now. So we have this app, but it's an app that will push content to the user's phone during the show at key moments. You will get alerts at certain times during the show. There will be an interactive element to it where you can text and hashtag things that will then appear on the screen in the show.
In addition to adding in all this wonderful tech,
You're also making some changes with regards to gender and characters. So tell me about the choices you made about who got to be female, who before was male.
A lot of that choice came from experimentation and just reading the play in different variations with men and women in a lot of the different roles. What I came to, the first role that I decided needed to switch to female was Cassius. So she is Cassia in this production. Because the action of this character is to go to everybody and build this conspiracy and build all these people that are on the team, and every single person on the team asks this character, "Did you get Brutus yet? Did you get Brutus?" And everybody keeps asking for this. I'm like, who's the person who needs a man to front them? And I look at the world that we're living in right now when you see women running for president and they're vetted in a very different way by the public eye. And I look at that and I say, a woman needs that. A woman needs a man to front. And I'm not saying a woman needs a man to front it, but in the public eye, it is assumed that a woman needs a man in order to get an agenda accomplished. And I hate that about our reality, but I also find it to be truthful. So I was like, okay, Cassius has to be female. And that for me made sense why everybody's like, I'll do it if Brutus is on board. I think people are used to seeing women function in these capacities now, and I think it's odd if you don't have women in this story. Because if you modernize it and you have a world in which there are only men in the Senate, that's weird for us, even though there are, you know, when you look at the numbers, there are many, 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 many more men in that body than there are women. But there are enough women in that body that not having them there is strange. Just like if you flip the entire play and have it all women, that's also strange.
What gets in the way, just generally speaking, of women playing male roles as women in Shakespeare?
I think tradition. I think it's just because we haven't really full scale started talking about how we can have, there's been two reactions. There's been, you know, one key role like Hamlet, you know, played by Sarah Bernhardt. You know, we have a tradition of women playing Hamlet or one key role. But what we don't have is just a full-scale balancing of gender in the plays. Then we have the other reaction, which is all female versions of things, which I think creates the same problem in a different way. Because now you have a world that's all female, and so I ask the question, why? We just haven't, as a course of practice, we have not decided that this is something that we do. It's starting to pop up. I'm not the only one doing this, but it's starting to pop up that we look at this and say, okay, look at the role, who should play the role, and, you know, not say we need five guys and two women, you know.
You are an actor as well as a director and an adapter. Do you feel a sense of need that more female actors need to get busy creating things for other female actors to be able to get roles that they ordinarily wouldn't be able to do? You're creating opportunities with adaptations like this. Do you feel the need to continue doing that?
Yes, because I think if you look particularly at classical theater, if you look at who's allowed to do this professionally, and you look at the size of the female roles in Shakespeare, in the canon, even the biggest of them, they don't even compare. So if you look at who gets a union contract, which means who gets health insurance, it comes down to that. Who gets a union contract? Who gets health insurance? And if the female roles are not made larger, you can't justify giving an equity contract to them. So you're basically deprofessionalizing women within the profession. And I think the only way to make sure that this gets looked at, even though people have great intentions on this issue, if you hand them a play that already does it, I think you're making it easier for this to happen faster. I think it'll happen anyway, but I would like it to happen faster.
As an actor, how did that impact you as an adapter, looking at the dialogue, looking at how you wanted to do the pacings of the scene? How did that actorly part of your brain talk to the writerly part of your brain?
You know, first of all, just looking at the gender perspective, making sure that the roles that I was giving to women were substantial and that they weren't just, you know, sort of a smaller character, that at every level, there were women at every level of role size in the play. But then also looking at the dialogue, there's small things. There's like little small things, like Cassius has a line that is, "I cannot tell what you and other men think of this life, but for my single self, I had this leaf not be, then live to be in awe of such a thing as myself." But when a woman says it, the word men is different. So I cannot tell what you and other men think of this life. So like there's small specificities that come out from a female voice in it that are surprising and sometimes interesting, and sometimes you have to change a word because of them. So it's more like surgical alterations to allow the female voice to be present in the text.
For those who have seen Julius Caesar before, when they come to see this play, did you keep the poetry completely intact?
I wouldn't say completely. I would say it's about 80% Shakespeare's original Julius Caesar play, about 10% things I've stolen from other Shakespeare plays, about 5% current Roman philosophers from the time of Julius Caesar, and about 5% original dialogue.
So you really went deep in finding things to add in here. What other plays did you steal from?
Well, mainly Coriolanus, because it's another play set in Rome about politics, so that's an obvious place to pilfer. Then I stole a bit from King Lear. There's a little bit of Midsummer. There's a little bit of Henry IV, Part One. There's tiny pieces from a bunch of other plays, including Measure for Measure. So I really just went, I was like, this is what I want to say. And then I would think about every play where a character is in that frame of mind, and then I'd go look and see if there's any text I could lift. And some of the stuff I knew already, because it's in my brain. If I've done the play, it stays in my brain somewhere in a cold storage. But if, you know, if I didn't know specifically, I'd be like, oh, Edgar says this, something like this. Let me go look at Edgar and everything Edgar says. Oh, this line. And I'll take it. And then the stuff from the Roman philosophers, I'm like, I want to talk about ambition. I want to talk about death. I want to talk about this. And so I would go and say, literally just Google Cato the Younger, death, and see what he had to say. And just like try to, you know, and I read the entire epic poem by this guy named Lucretius that is called On the Nature of Things, that is mostly a scientific document of Epicurean philosophy. And it is Nazi crackers. But there's parts of it that are in beautiful verse, and they are in the public domain, so I can steal them. And it's already in a meter that blends beautifully. And there's some musings on people and their involvement in ambition that are really useful. So I pilfered those as well.
So the people who are real Shakespeare fans are going to come into this, and they're kind of have a field day because it's almost like you've inserted Easter eggs.
Oh, yeah. If you are a Shakespeare buff and you know your stuff, you're going to recognize all the stuff that I stole. Even if you don't necessarily know where I stole it from, you'll be like, I know that's not from this play. Wait a minute. And it might drive you insane. But yeah, there's some of that. There's some what I call fake spear, which is things that sound like Shakespeare that I've actually written that are kind of in meter and sort of tack on. And then there's Shakespeare from other plays. And then there is stuff from other sources that is mainly philosophers.
You once worked on a presidential campaign. Which one?
I did. I worked for Ralph Nader in 2000 in the big infamous spoiler election of 2000.
So what did you glean from that you were able to use in this adaptation of Caesar?
Well, first of all, just the way that a campaign works, the way that D.C. works, and this play is not set in D.C., and I'm not trying to make it look like D.C., but the way that when a campaign is going on, the way that the staffers from each of the campaigns cross-pollinate in the popular bars. So if you look at, like, DuPont Circle at night, you have the campaign from these staffers and these staffers and these staffers are all in the same room. And I thought that was kind of interesting. I also thought it was interesting how many times we would compromise on a campaign ideal publicly. So there would be something like we were the Green Party for Ralph Nader. And without spoiling anything, we had a diesel van at one point that needed to go out. And they asked us to remove the diesel sticker from the back. So like these small things that were like, this is a violation of a public perception of an ethic that we are supposed to be holding in this party. So it's just like small compromises that, you know, even in a candidate I very much believed in, yet there's these small compromises. I'm like, this is how it starts.
What do you hope audiences will take away from the play? They're talking in the car, talking on the bus. What do you hope they're talking about?
I'd love them to talk about the speech that Brutus has toward the end of the play that is really looking at, is it better to stick with the status quo and live within what's here, or is it better to try to usurp what is there because that creates chaos and power vacuum? And like, what is the solution here, given that takeover or, you know, assassination is a completely insane thing to do and will never come to good? It never has in history. It's the one thing we keep repeating that we every time get the same result. But what can be done? What should be done? How do we deal with it when we have opposing viewpoints? How do we actually find a way to communicate and change the world when we have distinctly opposing viewpoints? Because I do think this is a place where we're sitting in the world, and it's not just America, it's all across the world. We have this bifurcated sort of population, and at some point it is going to come to a head, or we're going to find a way to talk to each other. And those are our two options, and I would love for them to be walking away talking about what else can we do other than this. What else can we do other than bring it to violence?
That's Ketta Carpenter. Her adaptation, Caesar, runs in rotation at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival through August 10th at the Illinois State University Center for Performing Arts. I'm Laura Kennedy.
You can hear Ketta Carpenter talk about the ways in which we use technology to engage in public political discourse in bonus audio at our website, wglt.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a mural is going away from the Bloomington Normal community. No, not that mural. We'll tell you which one. It has to do with labor history, though. in just a few minutes. The leader of a Springfield soul R&B funk mostly cover band has a special ingredient that separates them from other area bands. Tony Young's The Bad Boys return to Jazz Up Front in Bloomington tonight. Young tells GLT's John Norton, infusing jazz into their soulful sound, originals or covers, gives the outfit its special sauce.
So whether we're doing R&B, blues, or heavy funk, the way we do things, it makes it our own.
So when you say infused with jazz, what do you mean? I mean, are you more like a Herbie Hancock influence or a Miles Davis influence to what you're doing?
No, actually, we're not. It's just that what we do, our keyboard player, Jerry Cole, is our music director, and he's classically trained. And we use a lot of the minor chords that are used in some of the jazz music that's being played. So whether we're doing Earth, Wind, and Fire or Marvin Gaye or whomever we decide to do, you can always hear that flavor, and we don't hear any of the bands that sound like us because of the way we do our music. And I think that's what's one of the things that's made us very popular.
Your intention is to get people on the dance floor, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. We get them on the dance floor. We get them to show us their feelings. We do a Prince number, of course, Purple Rain, and oftentimes when we do that, we get people out there crying.
What is it about what you do to that song or maybe others that strikes a chord that other bands maybe aren't doing?
Well, for us, every time we perform a number, our goal is to reach out and touch someone within that audience. And the way my keyboard player plays, the bass player, my drummer and my guitar player, and my drummer is actually a percussionist as well, and the other two females that sing with me, it is a way that we can actually reach in and touch you. I mean, that's the one thing we keep hearing when we play, is that we actually felt you. And not only did they feel us, they actually wanted to hear more of what we had to do. So the originals that we're trying to do, some jazz, some R&B, and some heavy funk, that is done with that particular intent.
When you say heavy funk, are you talking about Funkadelic and Parliament and bands like that?
Funkadelic, Parliament, Rick James, we'll do anything. We've got about 110 songs that we can do. What's nice about what we do is we can tailor make the event. For example, we're going to be doing a 20-year reunion for a high school here from the 90s. So they want all 90s music, 80s and 90s music. So we're tailor making that right now, which includes adding some rap in that as well. So the neo soul, which has started to come alive again, I think people want to hear what they grew up with.
I won't wear you down, no honey, I won't wear you down.
Neo soul, what is your definition of that? Because mine is what it sounded like in the 60s and 70s, you know, Al Green and artists like that, but a lot of my younger friends sort of define it as more of that synth sound. Where do you fall in that?
Well, I mean, for us, neo-soul encompasses the old school, but as well as the new school. It has that very jazz, somewhat jazz flavor. It's so smooth that it doesn't matter whether you like neo-soul or not, you can relate to the music. It reaches out and touches you, and that's the main thing that we do. Whenever we do a number, whether it be a neo-soul number, R&B number, we turn it, make it our own so that the people can relate to it. The blues numbers that we even do, some of that we've actually turned into some neo-soul, whereby you can relate to it. If you know anything about Ledisi or Mesa, Jill Scott, any of those artists, you'll understand where we're going with that.
Our guest is Tony Young from the Bad Boys out of Springfield. There are not a lot of bands in Central Illinois that I'm aware of playing the kind of music you're doing. Dexter O'Neill and Funkyard out of Peoria. You know, Hip Pocket used to play some of that funky thing around Bloomington Normal in Central Illinois, but there's not a whole lot. Is Springfield a little bit different that way?
Springfield is basically, it's a blues, a rock, city. I mean, literally, you've got one or two bands that play here quite often. So that's why we don't play a lot in Springfield, because they usually like to hear the same band. So we've spread ourselves to other locations. Dexter O'Neill's band is phenomenal. I'll give a plug to Dexter because he and I both play at Jazz Up Front with James Gatson. The music that he provides is what we do as well, but we also do a little twist. We could be in the middle of Earth, Wind, and Fire, and the next thing you hear is Isley Brothers in that too. It's one of those things where people go, wow, that's different. It's your thing. It's your thing. Do what you want to do now. I can't tell you who to sock you to.
Say on your website, The Bad Boys, living proof that talent, hard work, and dedication can still prevail in the local live band scene. What are your goals, Tony, for the band?
We want to record. We want to be known. All of us have real jobs. That's always the key if you're a musician, until you get to a point where you don't have to have a real job. So we're hoping that by getting our record out there, somebody will hear us. And they'll like what we do, particularly with our originals, and go from there. Now, I myself, I'm 59 years old. I don't expect to become a superstar. But with the people in my group, if I may mention Jerry Cole on keyboards, Keegan Cunningham on the drums and percussion, you know, John Virgin on guitar, Charlie Fox on the bass, Tiffany Mathis, my vocal, she's my other half, and the other lady that we have, Alexandria Ali, our young one, she's also awesome. So if I put those two together, put them on a record, I think people are going to take notice.
But up here in Bloomington, it's really a singer-songwriter sort of market, where Peoria is more of a rock market. What's the Springfield market? Does it have a sort of a central theme to it music-wise?
It does. Springfield, number one, there are so many bands that are right here in Springfield, and I'm talking quality bands. Oftentimes, you'll see that those bands are the ones playing in the state fair. Several of the bands do a lot of touring. One of the names I'll mention right now, who's absolutely fabulous, his name is Brandon Santini. If you haven't heard Brandon Santini, look him up. He plays here quite often. Then we have another band, Capital Sound, Captain Geach, New City Road, which is a country band. But then, of course, we've got our blues artists that are here as well. It's a diverse group of musicians that can do just about anything you want. And if you come to Springfield on the weekend, we've got four or five beer gardens that are here, and they're all packed.
Tony Young, leader of Springfield's The Bad Boys, speaking with GLT's John Norton. The Bad Boys return to Jazz Up Front in downtown Bloomington tonight. Music begins at 8:30. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A mural is disappearing from the community. It's at the Labor's Hiring Hall on Fox Creek Road in Bloomington. That building is no longer used for that purpose. It was a youthful work, the mural, by then art student Carrie Sandhaus in 1988. Pictures scenes of labor history in Bloomington Normal. Sandhaus and labor historian Mike Matika join us. Matika and Sandhaus are also married to each other. Sandhaus says she has a particular interest in public art and had studied prominent muralists such as Diego Rivera. She says she was aware of the community expression murals can capture.
To me, I had already a real interest in public art and how that can express something of value, and in particular, histories that are lost in a community.
Before we go into the elements of this particular mural, let's talk about how long-lasting such public art is in the collective community consciousness, and when and why it may or may not age out. What are your thoughts on those sensibilities? And well, yes, I will be asking about the Uptown mural.
Okay. I think that we live in a digital age, and we go and take photographs now, not with film. We do them digitally. And so I think our sense of where images exist has shifted, you know, over the last decades of that, the whole emergence of the digital age. And so for me, what gave me a sense of satisfaction with this mural having lived its life is that the building in which it exists, and it's on the inside of a labor union hiring hall, which has outlived its life. The building is, you know, in, they've got a new labor hall. This particular hall, is, what do you call it, structurally and so forth. It's in its final, you know, years or days, I guess, at this point. So we enlisted Ken Cashin, who is an extraordinary photographer, to photograph the mural, and then he pieced together the 20-foot width of it so that there is a complete image. So there's a digital image of this mural. So I feel that we've captured that, and the laborers union is interested in planning to have a reproduction of it made on a smaller scale to fit within their new hall, and there's some talk of some other possibilities of reproductions. So for me, it's lived its life in a place where it lived to a grand old age, I guess.
Super. More generally, though, how does the iconography that goes into establishing the composition of a mural change as society changes? How have murals in this community shifted? I mean, there have been murals of African Americans on downtown buildings where the Black History Project came in. Mm-hmm. Now there are several youth murals in mm-hmm. different areas of the community. There's, of course, the notable Uptown mural, which mm-hmm. has been a focus of some controversy. But what do those have in common? What is different about each of those?
I think that probably this mural has the most in common with what Joel Bergner has done with the youth murals, in that there's something expressed that's collective about a group in the community. And so this mural, being about local labor history, expressed different events and challenges and struggles and so forth of the unions and labor in the Bloomington Normal community. And I think that the other kinds of mural projects, so I've got a piece in the mural that is on Market Street in downtown Bloomington. And so I also participated in one of those kinds of murals that is there are discrete parts. It's more like a patchwork quilt, you know, so that you've got individual sections of the mural that are an expression of that individual artist, whereas another kind of mural that is more of a unified piece that's an expression of a group as a whole. So to me, that's one of those distinctions between those. I think that with regard to the Bloomington mural, they did a really nice job with the Downtown Bloomington Association of documenting the mural in like a calendar that came out. And so there are photographs, again, back to the digital expression of that shared that mural out in other ways. And so while that mural in particular is not in jeopardy, and the one in Uptown Normal is, if I had participated in the Uptown mural, to me, seeing that mural be photographed and have some replication somewhere, whether that's, you know, as a poster or as a larger scale piece, would be just as satisfying as keeping it out, you know, in, because our world changes, you know.
There's another mural in the post office in mm-hmm. Uptown Normal, mm-hmm. made by a student of Diego Rivera, uh-huh. and you referenced him earlier.
Yeah.
What does that have in common with yours? It was an image of community and the founding of the community, and yours is an image of labor and the seminal historical moments of labor in this community. Is there anything else to draw those two together in your mind?
I wonder if there's a bit of social realism. I mean, in terms of the kind of artistic approach, is that the kind of thing you're thinking about, mm-hmm. Charlie?
Well, actually, I was hoping you would have something to say.
Something else to say about. I guess the mural in the post office is in itself a kind of historic artifact, because there were so many murals done during that time period of the WPA, you know, murals that were done in a lot of different post offices and other, you know, public buildings. So I think that you know, that's certainly a kind of community artifact that you wouldn't want to let go of. And so I think that, you know, it's, I'm glad that we still have the post office there with that mural. And if ever that post office needed to come down, I would hope they would document that in an appropriate way that it could be preserved. You know,
this is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker with Carrie Sandhaus, the artist of a mural about Bloomington Normandy labor history. It is having its last public showing from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Labor's Local 362 Old Hall on Fox Creek Road. There are several moments that we should talk about. With us also is Mike Matika, Carrie's husband, who is a bit of a labor historian himself. The one of the scenes in the mural is the Chicago and Alton Railroad shops. Why is that a key moment for this community in labor history?
When you look at economic development of Bloomington Normal, the location of the Chicago and Alton Railroad shops here in 1854 is like Rivian today. It is the high-tech industry of the day. It's also the birthplace of labor unions. Railroad work was very dangerous, very hazardous. And beginning in the 1860s, railroad workers were already organizing themselves. So as, number one, a group that early on built unions, early on came together and became a community force. And a very significant event in 1922 is in the mural when 400,000 railroad shop workers across the country went on strike after their wages and overtime had been cut. A federal court injunction came down that basically outlawed that strike. And Bloomington is written up in national newspapers at the time period as one of the epicenters of that activity. So that workplace is, until the day of State Farm, is the primary workplace of Bloomington Normal, and it is a labor union-intensive workplace.
How about the bike candy strike, or the it's now Ferraro candy, and that shop has receded in the community's collective consciousness somewhat over the years. It was a big deal back in the early 90s when it was still going strong. It's somewhat smaller now as a workforce. Lift that up to today's listeners who may not even know about Bike or Ferraro.
Yeah, and again, Ferraro, formerly Nestle, formerly Bike, you know, still makes candy on the southwest side of town. Their old plant, which was right by the railroad tracks on Front Street, was, again, a very important industrial workplace. About 300 to 400 people worked there, but mostly women. And I remember interviewing Dora Giese, who packed and wrapped 24 candy bars in a box when she started in 1934 and got a penny a box. So when those workers organized in 1937-38, they were very much worried about their condition, and it was a women's-led movement, and they were pretty militant. And Carrie can share, as this was being painted, again, this work of art as a collective community expression, people were bringing in photographs of their grandmothers and their mothers saying, she was there. Can you put her in this mural?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that was one of the particularly satisfying aspects of working on this mural. Mike had done a lot of kind of history research in the late 70s on local labor history here in Bloomington Normal. And this mural came, I guess, is actually builds on that foundation of research that he did. But once those stories started to be gathered, then we identified where those people were, and people did bring out their photographs. So different faces in the mural are based on those photographs of individuals, as well as I had to get the styles of the day. So it was looking at Sears catalog and of the time period, like from the Bike Candy Company workers, you know, what kinds of clothing did they have, because they may have had, you know, close-up shots of the faces, but not necessarily, you know, fully clothed.
That's also what a mural does. It's a piece of contemporary art when it goes up for most murals. Does its meaning and accessibility change as styles of the day change?
Mm, that's a good point.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, there was a lot of pride in this, pride in particularly Carrie's artwork. But here's a place where every morning there were 70 to 90 laborers waiting for work. There were numerous political meetings. There were multiple unions that met there. Never once did anybody graffiti. Never once did anybody try to do anything to this, even though dozens of people were in and out. And I think that shows that sense that this was ours. This belonged to the group. And so there was a lot of respect shown toward this piece of artwork. And again, people often, what's that? What's this scene? What does that mean? And oftentimes bring groups in and tours.
Was that still happening even until the hiring hall was made obsolete?
Well, even afterwards, like the Multicultural Leadership Program would meet there at least once a year and get a little bit of an introduction to that. And people would say, oh, I had no idea that was part of our history, you know, as mm-hmm. we described the different scenes there.
The mural also includes an image of Mother Jones, who came to Bloomington to support the streetcar conductor's strike, and an image of the 1978 Normal firefighter strike, the longest firefighter strike ever in the nation, and one in which the entire union was ordered to jail. The next day after Mother Jones arrived, though, the governor of that time called out the National Guard and camped more than 1,000 troops on the courthouse square. Artist Carrie Sandhaus and labor historian Mike Matika joined us for that conversation about murals and the labor history mural she painted in 1988. The mural will be available for its last showing 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday at Labor's Local 362 in the Old Hall on Fox Creek Road in Bloomington. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. And thanks to Mary Cullen, Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and John Norton for their help today. I'm Charlie Schlenker.